Today is Wednesday, June 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden traveled to Tulsa, Oklahoma, to commemorate the deadliest racial incident in American history.
My fellow Americans, this was not a riot. This was a massacre.
Plus, representatives of warring parties in Afghanistan are set to return to the negotiation table in Qatar this week, and scientists warn of a severe Atlantic hurricane season. We'll have these stories and more next. U.S. President Joe Biden visited Tulsa, Oklahoma on Tuesday to commemorate the centennial of the Tulsa Race Massacre, a white mob's terrifying 1921 destruction of a black community.
The events we speak of today took place 100 years ago, and yet I'm the first president in 100 years ever to come to Tulsa. And I say that not as a compliment about me, but to think about it. 100 years and the first president to be here during that entire time. And in this place, in this ground, to acknowledge the truth of what took place here. For much too long, the history of what took place here was told in silence, cloaked in darkness. But just because history is silent, it doesn't mean that it did not take place. And while darkness can hide much, it erases nothing.
Biden paid his respects to the last three known survivors of the 1921 massacre before recounting the bloody event in detail.
While Green was a community to itself, it was not separated from the outside. It wasn't everyone, but there was enough hate, resentment, and vengeance in the community. Enough people who believed that America does not belong to everyone and not everyone is created equal. Native Americans, Asian Americans, Hispanic Americans, Black Americans, a belief enforced by law, by badge, by hood, and by noose that speaks to that lit the fuse. It lit it by the spark that it provided. A fuse of fury was an innocent interaction that turned into a terrible, terrible headline allegation of a black male teenager attacking a white female teenager. A white mob of 1,000 gathered around the courthouse where the black teenager is being held, ready to do what still occurred, lynch that young man that night. But 75 black men, including black veterans, arrived to stand guard. Words were exchanged, then a scuffle, then a shots fired. Hell was unleashed. Literal hell was unleashed. Through the night and into the morning, the mob terrorized Greenwood, torches and guns, shooting at will. A mob tied a black man by the waist to the back of their truck with his head banging along the pavement as they drove off. A murdered black family draped over the fence of their home outside. An elderly couple knelt by their bed praying to God with their heart and their soul when they were shot in the back of their heads. Private planes dropping explosives. The first and only domestic aerial assault of its kind on an American city, here in Tulsa. 8 of Greenwood's nearly 24 churches burned, like Mount Zion across the street at Vernon AME. Mother Randall said it was like a war. Mother Fletcher says all these years later, she still sees black bodies around. The Greenwood newspaper publisher, A.J. Smitherman, penned a poem of what he heard and felt that night. And here's the poem. He said, "Kill them, burn them, set the pace, teach them how to keep their place. Reign of murder, theft, and plunder was the order of the night." That's what he remembers. in the poem that he wrote. 100 years ago, at this hour, on this first day of June, smoke darkened the Tulsa sky, rising from 35 blocks of Greenwood that were left in ash and ember, raised in rubble. In less than 24 hours, 1,100 black homes and businesses were lost. Insurance companies, they had insurance, many of them, rejected claims of damage. 10,000 people were left destitute and homeless, placed in internment camps. As I was told today, they were told, don't you mention you were ever in a camp, or we'll come and get you. That's what survivors told me. Yet no one, no arrests of the mob were made, none. No proper accounting of the dead. The death toll records by local officials said there were 36 people. That's all, 36 people. Based on studies, records, and accounts, the likely number is much more in the multiple of hundreds. Untold bodies dumped into mass graves. Families who at a time waited for hours and days to know the fate of their loved ones are now descendants who have gone 100 years without closure. But you know, as we speak, the process of exhuming the unmarked graves has started. My fellow Americans, this was not a riot. This was a massacre.
Now between the ages of 101 and 107, the survivors who met with Biden asked Congress for justice this year. They're parties to a lawsuit against state and local officials seeking several remedies for the massacre, including a victim's compensation fund. Biden did not answer a reporter's question about whether there should be an official U.S. presidential apology for the incident, and his spokeswoman did not say whether the president would discuss whether reparations should be paid to the descendants of the people who were affected. In Africa, a Ugandan army spokesperson said an unidentified gunman attacked the transport minister and former defense forces chief General Edward Katumba Wamala on Tuesday while traveling in an army vehicle with his daughter. The army said that while he was injured, his daughter and driver were killed. Halima Athumani has the details.
The former chief of defense forces, General Edward Katumba Wamala, was leaving his home in an army land cruiser when unknown assailants traveling on two motorcycles shot at the vehicle, according to authorities. Brigadier Flavia Wekwaso, the army spokesperson, spoke to VOA about the incident.
Assailants riding on borders shot at his vehicle. The occupant saw the car, including his daughter, and the driver died on spot. At this point in time, I can't tell whether it was an attempted assassination. The investigation has already started, and they shall be releasing the details as they come in.
The general, who is mainly referred to as Katumba, is now being treated for his injuries at a hospital cordoned off by the army. Katumba spoke to two other daughters from his hospital bed.
I've survived. I've lost a brain. That's good. It's been nothing to this world. But the bad guys are blind. And God has given me a vengeance. I pulled through. Don't worry, I don't have bad injuries, only the arms, but I'll be fine.
This will be the 37th such attack since 2015. The 36 previous ones ended with the deaths of the targeted victims, including a police spokesperson, Muslim clerics, and a state prosecutor, Joan Kagezi, who was working on an Al-Shabaab attack-related murder trial. Kagezi was the lead prosecutor in the trial of 13 men accused of the 2010 bombings in Kampala, in which 76 people were killed while watching the World Cup. General Katumba was chief of defense forces from 2013 to 2017. He also became Inspector General Police in 2001. Katumba was the first military officer to serve with the police. Katumba is the outgoing Works and Transport Minister. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Gambia's Truth Commission has wrapped up more than 2 years of public hearings into alleged human rights violations committed during the 22-year rule of former dictator Yahya Jammeh. Witness testimony concluded on Friday, delivering accounts of arbitrary arrests, torture, corruption, and summary executions, and in some cases, with the victims' bodies being fed to crocodiles. Jammeh took power in a 1994 coup, controlling the tiny West African nation, until losing the presidency to Adama Barrow in a December 2016 election. Jammeh, who is now 56, fled with his wife into exile in Equatorial Guinea. The commission is expected to submit a report to the president in July, and Barrow will then have 6 months to implement the commission's recommendations. As fighting in pockets of Ethiopia's Tigray region continues, local farmers are facing a shortage of seeds and fertilizer, leading to dwindling food supplies. Reuters' Louisa Knox has more.
These people are waiting for packages that could save their lives. Scarred by an ongoing conflict, people in Ethiopia's Tigray region are now facing another threat: dwindling food supplies. Stores are running low, and as planting season approaches, farmers are running out of seeds and fertilizer. Without the supplies, thousands will run out of food as they wait for harvests. And that's why the International Committee of the Red Cross, in partnership with the Ethiopian Red Cross Society, is distributing seeds and fertilizers to 16,000 families in Tigray's central zone. Haragu Tashale is grateful for the help.
We are very happy to receive the fertilizers. The land cannot grow crops without fertilizer, and the fertilizers we had were looted.
Agriculture is the primary source of livelihood in rural Tigray. The mountainous area's climate and soil pose significant challenges to farmers who depend heavily on fertilizer. Since armed conflict flared up last November, subsidized seeds and fertilizers have become unavailable. Meleka Van Klinken is a team leader for the ICRC's Economic Security Program.
What they were worried the most as the conflict started and as everything was going on, what stresses them the most is the lack of being able to produce food. So this has driven them to continue farming, to continue plowing their lands, and the reaction has been overwhelming.
The ICRC has warned that families who still can eat two meals a day may soon be forced to have just one.
Louisa Knox from Reuters. The United Nations World Food Program said that it was providing emergency food assistance to over 1 million people since it started its distribution in March in northwestern and southern zones of the Ethiopian Tigray region, adding that 5.2 million people, equivalent to 91% of Tigray's population, need emergency food assistance due to the conflict. Representatives of warring parties in Afghanistan are set to return to the negotiation table in Qatar this week. They'll discuss, among other pressing issues, a de-escalation in Afghan violence as international forces continue to withdraw from the conflict-torn country. Afghan officials have confirmed members of their negotiation team have left for Doha on Tuesday, but they did not discuss when they will meet Taliban interlocutors. The United States' pullout from Afghanistan is speeding up, with military planners saying that almost half of the U.S. forces and equipment have been sent home and that some equipment has been destroyed. Egypt's foreign ministry spokesperson protested Tuesday after Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed indicated that he was planning to build 100 small to medium-sized dams during the coming year. There is still no resolution to the ongoing conflict of filling the Renaissance Dam along the Nile River inside Ethiopian territory. Edward Uranian reports.
Egyptian media broadcast an angry statement by Foreign Ministry spokesman Ahmed Hafez criticizing Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's declaration about building 100 new small and medium-sized dams on waterways across his country during the next year. Hafez indicated the plan is a sign of Ethiopia's ill intentions regarding the conflict over filling the Renaissance Dam, which has caused the casus belli with both Egypt and neighboring Sudan. Hafez added that Ethiopia must coordinate such plans with its neighbors before causing them damage. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi visited Djibouti last week, insisting during a press conference he was still hoping to negotiate a diplomatic solution to the conflict with Ethiopia over filling the dam. Sisi says he discussed the Renaissance Dam situation, which affects the interest of the entire region, and the need for a fair and balanced agreement over filling and operating the dam as soon as possible. And Egypt's refusal of the effort of any party to impose its own plan that doesn't meet the interests or rights of countries whose interests are affected. Egyptian political sociologist Said Sadik tells VOA the issue of Ethiopia filling the Renaissance Dam for a second year starting in July has provoked the wrath of the Egyptian public.
Public opinion is very angry and is pushing the government to react to the provocation of Ethiopian politicians and media who are all the time speaking in a very provocative way against the Egyptian people and the Egyptian government.
Sadik went on to say that Egyptian opposition forces based mostly outside the country were calling for protests over what they claimed was the government's mishandling of the crisis. Sadik added that Egyptian officials were perplexed over the unwillingness of influential foreign power brokers like the European Union, the United States, and the African Union to use their influence to reach a diplomatic solution to the crisis. Paul Sullivan, a professor at the U.S. National Defense University in Washington, tells VOA that Ethiopia's construction of the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam is inflaming enough, but building 100 more dams creates greater incitement and is an accelerating aggression. He goes on to stress that Egypt will need to respond, and if Ethiopia wants peace, they are giving indications of just the opposite. If this comes to war, he argues, all will lose, and massively. He says a reasonable settlement would be ideal, but that things seem to be going in the opposite direction. The Egyptian military has been conducting maneuvers with a number of regional countries in recent days, including Sudan, in order to show its readiness in the event a conflict erupts. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Pro-democracy demonstrators took to the streets in towns around Myanmar on Tuesday to denounce the country's military, marking 4 months since it ousted an elected government and unleashed a wave of nationwide anger. Despite a bloody crackdown by security forces, Myanmar's military is still struggling to impose order amid protests and strikes and fighting on multiple fronts and border regions as civilians take up arms against the junta. Security forces have killed 840 people since the coup, according to figures from activists cited by the United Nations. The junta says that only about 300 people have died. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A former director of opposition group Open Russia has been removed from a plane in St. Petersburg and arrested. Reuters reporter Edward Baran has that story.
Andrei Pivovarov was arrested at Pulkovo Airport. Tatiana Usmanova is the former coordinator of Open Russia.
After the whole world discussed what Lukashenko did in Minsk, doing practically the same thing in St. Petersburg and stopping Andrei's plane that was already on the runway is the height of insanity, and it shows a lack of respect for human rights.
Open Russia said last week that it had decided to end operations in Russia to protect its members from the risk of being jailed. Russia declared the London-based group, quote, undesirable in 2017, effectively banning its activities. Its allies in Russia continued their activism under the same name, but as a separate legal entity to protect themselves from prosecution.
Reuters, Edward Baran. A Belarusian opposition activist, Stepan Lipau, stabbed himself in the throat with a pen during a court hearing in Minsk on Tuesday. He was protesting what he claimed were threats from authorities to arrest his family members and friends if he did not plead guilty to organizing protests against the country's authoritarian ruler, President Alexander Lukashenko. Vesna Human Rights Center in Belarus said Lipau was put into an induced coma, and his lawyer declined to comment further on his condition. If convicted, Lipau faces up to 10 years in prison. In addition, Belarusian opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya said on Tuesday that she had asked the United States for further sanctions on individuals and companies supporting the Belarus government. The Biden administration said on Friday that it was drawing up a list of targeted sanctions against key members of the Belarusian government. The move follows the former Soviet Republic's forced landing of a passenger jet and the arrest of journalist Roman Protasevich and his girlfriend Sofia Sapega on board. The European Union's new prosecutor's office opened its doors in Luxembourg Tuesday. It's tasked with cracking down on fraud just before the 27 member states receive a $920 million injection of post-coronavirus recovery funds. Lisa Bryant reports that not all have signed onto the initiative, and one country, Slovenia, maybe putting up some roadblocks.
The European Public Prosecutor's Office, or EPPO, is two decades in the making. Now it's a reality, a body aimed to tackle economic and financial crime involving EU funds. It's headed by Romanian anti-fraud prosecutor Laura Kövesi.
Make no mistake, this is the most common threat to any democratic society. It is underreported, underestimated, often even tolerated to the benefit of organized criminal organizations that aspire to subvert and replace legitimate authorities.
So far, 22 of the 27 EU member states are participating in the body. Each will have one prosecutor working at the central office in Luxembourg and at least two others based in their home countries. It's expected to deal with about 3,000 cases a year. Justice Commissioner Didier Reynders said reported EU budget fraud amounted to more than $600 million in 2019 alone. Ordinary EU citizens can also report possible financial...
The protection of the Union's financial borders of the EU. The trail of fraud and money laundering often leads us to jurisdictions in our immediate vicinity and beyond. This is why the EPPO has to create and nurture close bonds with the competent authorities of the participating member states, as well as those of the non-participating member states and third countries.
Several EU member states, including Hungary and Poland, have not joined the prosecutor's office. Reports say Sweden will join next year. Meanwhile, two members, Slovenia and Finland, have not yet filled their posts of in-country prosecutors. European officials say they expect Finland to do so shortly. That's not necessarily the case of Slovenia, which takes over the rotating EU presidency in July. Prosecutor Kövesi says that won't stop the office from working, but it could pose problems.
In my view, this is a lack of sincere cooperation, and this issue undermines the trust in effective functioning of the management and control system for EU in Slovenia.
Commissioner Reynders says if Slovenia doesn't cooperate soon, Brussels will consider ways to force it to meet its obligations. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Pope Francis has made sweeping changes to the Catholic Church law on sexual abuse crimes. Changes are aimed at not only punishing those in the church who commit such crimes, but also at making it harder for church officials to cover up offenses by priests. Sabina Castelfranco takes it from here.
Pope Francis has made a long-awaited and extensive revision of church law with specific attention to those who commit crimes related to sexual abuse. While abuse of minors was previously an offense under the title Crimes Against Special Obligations, it has now been moved to Offenses Against Human Life, Dignity and Liberty. Monsignor Filippo Iannone, head of the department charged with the project, explained the intention behind this change.
La volontà del legislatore di riaffermare.
The aim, he said, was to reaffirm the gravity of this crime and the attention that must be reserved for the victims. Since his election in 2013, Pope Francis has been speaking out against sexual abuse in the church and implementing changes aimed at bringing those responsible to justice. He has made great efforts at trying to bring more transparency and avoid cover-ups of those involved in abuse. Presenting the changes on Tuesday, Vatican officials said they will go into effect on December the 8th, the day the Church celebrates the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. The changes made to canon law recognize that both minors and adults can be victims of abuse. In addition, both clergy and lay people who hold church positions will have to answer for sexual offenses. While members of the church can be defrocked, lay people will pay for their offense either by losing their jobs or their place in their communities, or will receive fines. New crimes have also entered the code, such as grooming minors or vulnerable adults for sexual abuse and possessing child pornography. The changes also make it much more difficult for abusers to benefit from superiors covering up, as this will no longer be tolerated, and those who do not act against offenders will be held responsible and punished for their negligence. Monsignor Iannone said there was the need to strengthen the criminal code because of some existing situations of irregularity in communities, but above all, as he put it, because of recent scandals with disconcerting and very serious episodes of pedophilia. He also said there has been a climate of excessive slack in the interpretation of penal law, where mercy was sometimes put before justice.
La giustizia esige in questi casi che l'ordine violato venga ristabilito.
Monsignor Iannone concluded by saying that justice requires that the order that has been violated be re-established, that victims be eventually compensated, and that offenders be punished and paid for their crimes. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
The World Meteorological Organization warns the United States and countries in the Caribbean and Central America to be prepared for what is expected to be another above-normal Atlantic hurricane season. Lisa Schlein has those details.
The outlook for this year's hurricane season, which began Tuesday, is grim. Last year's record-breaking season had 30 named tropical storms, including 19 hurricanes, six of them major. The World Meteorological Organization says the 2021 Atlantic hurricane season is likely to be less active, with between 13 and 20 named storms, of which 6 to 10 could become hurricanes. WMO spokeswoman Claire Nullis says the coming season is likely to be particularly difficult for countries such as those in Central America that are still recovering from last year's devastating storms.
Emergency managers, you know, are obviously very concerned, you know, that if another tropical storm or hurricane does impact, you know, this will have serious consequences. It only takes one hurricane to make landfall in a season, you know, to wipe out years of social economic development.
Nullis says climate change has an influence on seasonal storms, which are increasing in intensity and frequency. She says carbon dioxide concentrations remain at record high levels and will continue to drive global warming.
That all naturally occurring climate events now take part in the context of climate change, which is increasing global temperatures. As we know, it's exacerbating extreme weather and it's impacting seasonal rainfall patterns.
While 2021 got off to a relatively cool start, Nullis cautions against believing that there is a pause in climate change. She notes the WMO predicts a 90% likelihood of at least 1 year between 2021 and 2025 becoming the warmest year on record, dislodging 2016 from the top ranking. Globally, average temperatures in 2016 were 0.99 degrees Celsius warmer than the mid-20th century mean. The Atlantic hurricane season ends November 30th. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.